or fired this rope at her. Whatever it was. She crashed onto the stone roof. "Damn," said Clef. "We've been spotted."
"No shit," said Sanchia.
She tried to start crawling away, but found she couldn't. The rope suddenly seemed impossibly heavy, as if it were not made of fibers, but rather lead. And no matter how she heaved, she could barely drag the coil of rope any farther than half an inch.
"It's scribed to think it's denser than it actually is," said Clef. "The more someone tries to move it, the denser it gets."
"So can we break it?"
She never finished, because then there was a second crack. She looked up in time to see a silvery rope hurtling toward her from a rooftop nearly a block away. It stretched out like someone opening their arms for an embrace before slamming into her chest, knocking her back onto the roof. She started to heave at it, but stopped.
"Wait, Clef, can I accidentally make it so dense that it could crush my chest?"
"It's a loop, so it'll distribute the force somewhat. You could make it so dense that you fall through the roof, though."
"Shit," she said.
She looked down at the cords. There seemed to be a locking mechanism on the side, awaiting a scribed key.
"Do something! Unlock me!"
"I can't. I'd have to be touching it."
Sanchia tried to pull him out of her shirt, but the second rope kept her arms tied fast to her body.
"I can't reach you."
"What do we do? What do we do?"
Sanchia stared up at the night sky.
I don't know.
They waited there, looking up, the chant of the scribed ropes echoing in Sanchia's ears. Then, after a long while, she heard footsteps coming close. Heavy ones. The bruised, scratched face of Captain Gregor Dandolo leaned overhead, a huge springle on his back. He smiled politely.
"Good evening, again."
Apparently, Captain Dandolo had the control for the ropes. After adjusting something on his springle, he was able to reduce their density enough that he could flip her over. He kept her bound, of course.
"Something we used back in the wars when capturing trespassers," he said merrily.
He grabbed the ropes with each hand and picked her up, much as one would a bound pig.
"I'd know the smell of the Michiel foundry smoke like I would the scent of jasmine. I had to come here all the time to commission armaments. Flame and heat, as one would expect, are useful when making war."
"Let me go, you dumb bastard," she said. "Let me go."
"No."
He somehow packed an infuriating amount of cheer into that one word.
"You put me in prison and they'll kill me."
"Who? Your client?" he said,
making his way for the stairs down.
"They won't be able to get at you. We'll put you in the Dandolo jailhouse, which is quite safe. Your only concern will be me, young lady."
Sanchia bucked and kicked and snarled, but Dandolo was quite strong and seemingly indifferent to her countless swears. He hummed happily as they started down the stairs. He exited the stairs and hauled her across the street to a scribed carriage bearing the Dandolo logotipo, the quill and the gear.
"Our chariot awaits," he said.
He opened up the back, set her down on the floor, and reactivated the scribings on the rope. There was some kind of dial on the side of the espringle, until she was pinned to the floor.
"I hope this will be comfortable during our short ride."
Then he looked her over, took a breath, and said,
"But first, I must ask, where is it?"
"Where's what?"
"The item you stole," he said.
"The box."
"Oh, shit," said Clef. "This guy isn't as stupid as he looks."
"I don't have it," said Sanchia, inventing a story as fast as she could. "I gave it over to my client."
"Did you?"
he said flatly.
"I don't think he believes you," said Clef.
"I know that. Shut the hell up, Clef."
"Yes," she said.
"Then why is your client trying to kill you if you did as they asked? That is why you're trying to escape the city, yes?"
"Yes," said Sanchia honestly. And I don't know why they're out for me or why they killed Sark.
That gave him pause. Sark is dead?
Yes.
Your client killed him?
Yes, yes!
He scratched his beard at his chin.
And I suppose you don't know who your client is.
No, we were never to know names and never to look in the box.
What did you do with it, then?
Sanchia decided on a story that was close to the truth. Sark and I took the box to an appointed place and time, an abandoned fishery in the Greens. Four men showed up, well-fed Campo sort. One took the box away and said he wanted to confirm it, left us with the other three. Then there was some signal, and they stabbed Sark and nearly killed me.
And you fought your way out?
She narrowed her eyes at him. Yes, she said defensively. His large, dark eyes flicked over her small frame.
All by yourself?
I'm decent enough in a fight.
What fishery was this?
By the Anifesto Channel. He nodded, thinking about this.
Anifesto way. Well then, he said, let's go have a look then.
He shut the door and climbed into the pilot's seat.
Look where, said Sanchia, startled.
To the Greens, said the captain. To this fishery of which you speak.
Presumably there will be dead bodies inside, yes?
Bodies that might suggest exactly who paid you to rob my waterfront.
Wait, you can't take me there, she cried. Just hours ago, there were dozens of big bastards walking around there, looking to gut me.
Then you had better stay quiet, hadn't you?
Sanchia lay perfectly still as the carriage rattled over the muddy commons lanes to the Greens. This was possibly the worst outcome for her. She'd intended to never return to the Greens, let alone trust up in Captain Gregor Dandolo's carriage.
You tell me the second you sense something big coming at me, okay? She said.
Why, so you can sit and watch your death approach? Said Clef.
Just do it, all right?
Finally, the carriage rolled to a stop. There was darkness outside the windows, but she could tell they were at the fisheries by the smell. Dread bloomed in her stomach as she remembered that night. Just last night, though it seemed so long ago now. For a long time, Dandolo said nothing. She imagined him sitting hunched in the cockpit, watching the streets and the fisheries. Then she heard his voice, quiet but confident.
Won't be a moment.
The carriage rocked slightly as he climbed out and slammed the door. Sanchia sat there and waited. And waited.
How the hell are we going to get out of this? Asked Clef.
No idea yet.
If he searches you, I mean, I'm just on a string around your neck.
Gregor Dandolo is a Campo gentleman, said Sanchia. He might also be a veteran, but deep down, all good Campo boys have absolutely no desire to touch a commons person, let alone feel up a commons girl's chest.
I think you've misjudged it. Wait.
What? There.
There is something scribed nearby.
Oh, God.
No, no, it's small, really small, tiny, even, easy to miss. It's like a dot stuck to the outside of the carriage in the back.
What's it doing?
It's trying to join something else, kind of like your construction scribings, I guess. It's like a magnet. It's pulling really hard towards something that must be kind of close.
Sanchia tensed up. She realized what must be happening.
Shit, she said. He's been followed.
What do you mean?
The cockpit door opened, and someone climbed in. Presumably Gregor Dandolo, but she couldn't see. Then she heard his voice quietly saying,
No bodies. None.
Sanchia blinked in shock.
But that's impossible.
Is it?
Yes. Yes!
Where ought there have been bodies, young miss?
Upstairs and on the stairs.
He looked over the back of the seat at her.
Are you sure? Positive?
She glared at him. Yes, damn it! He sighed.
I see. Well, I did find quite a bit of blood in both of those locations, so I must grudgingly admit that some aspect of your story appears to be at least somewhat true.
She stared at the ceiling, outraged. You were testing me! He nodded.
I was testing you.
You...
Do you know what was in the box?
He demanded suddenly. Surprised, Sanchia tried to recover. I told you, no! He stared off into the distance, thinking.
And I suppose you don't know anything about the Hierophants, he said softly.
Her skin went cold, but she said nothing.
Do you?
He asked. Beyond that they were magic giants? Said Sanchia. No.
I think you're lying. I think you're lying to me about something. About what was in the box. About how your deal went down. About how that blood got there.
God damn, said Clef. This guy is terrifying.
Are you sure that thing's on the back of the carriage?
Yeah. Bottom right if you're facing it.
And I think I'm about to save your life, she said.
Again.
Beg pardon. Walk around to the back of your carriage and look for something. It'll be stuck on the bottom right. Looks like a button, one that shouldn't be there. He narrowed his eyes at her.
What kind of ploy is this?
It's not a ploy at all. Go on, she said. I'll wait. He looked at her for a moment. Then he reached down and pulled at her ropes, confirming they were secure. Satisfied, he opened the door again and climbed out. She listened to the crunch of his feet outside. He stopped somewhere behind the carriage.
He got it, said Clef. Pried it off.
Gregor walked around and looked through the back passenger window at her.
What's this?
He asked, slightly outraged. He held it up. It looked like a big brass tack.
It's scribed on the bottom. What is this?
It's like a construction scribing, said Sanchia. It pulls at its twin like a magnet.
And why, he said, would someone want to stick a construction scribing to my carriage?
Think for a second, said Sanchia. They stick one half to your carriage. Then they tie another to a string. Then the string will act like a needle in a compass, always pointing to you like your true north. He stared at her. Then he looked around, peering at the streets behind him.
Now you're figuring it out? Asked Sanchia. See anyone?
He was silent. Then he thrust his head back through the window.
How did you know it was there? He demanded. How did you know what it was?
Intuition, she said.
Nonsense, he said. Did you put it there?
When could I have done that? When I was sleeping on the roof or tied up with your ropes? You need to let me go, Captain. They didn't put it on there to track you. They put it on there to find me. They're coming for me. They figured out you knew where I was, so they just followed you. And now you're right here in it with me. Let me go, and maybe you can survive this. He was quiet for a while. It strangely pleased her. For so long, it had seemed like the captain had ice in his veins, so it was nice to see him sweat.
No,
he said finally.
What?
She said, surprised. No? He dropped the button on the ground and stomped on it.
No.
He climbed back into the cockpit.
Just no?
Just no.
The carriage started off again.
You goddamn fool! She shouted at him. You're going to get us both killed!
You have damaged lives and careers through your actions, said the captain. Not just mine, but those of my officers. You harm those around you without reflection or compunction. I am obligated to amend that, and I will not permit any threat, any lie, or any attack
to dissuade me from my path.
Sanchia stared at the ceiling, stunned.
You smug idiot, she said. What right do you have to speak such flowery words with the Dandolo name hanging over you?
What does that have to do with it?
Harming people, using people, damaging lives, that's all the merchant houses ever do, she said. You people are every bit as dirty as I am.
That may be so,
said Dandolo, with infuriating serenity.
This place has a tainted heart. That I've seen up close. But I've also seen horrors out in the world, young lady. I learned to tame some of them, and I have come home to bring to this city the very thing I am delivering you to.
And what's that?
Justice, he said simply.
Her mouth fell open. What? Are you serious?
As serious, he said as the carriage turned. As the grave.
Sanchia laughed, incredulous. Oh, as simple as that. Just like dropping off a package. Here, friends, have some justice. That's the dumbest damned thing I ever heard.
All great things must start somewhere, he said. I started with the waterfront, which you burned down. By capturing you, I can continue.
She kept laughing. You know, I almost believe you. You and your holy crusade talk. But if you really are as noble and honest as you sound, Captain Dandolo, you won't live long. If there's one thing this city can't tolerate, it's honesty.
Let them try, he said. Many already have. I nearly died once. I can afford to do so again.
But he never finished his statement, because then the carriage went careening out of control. Gregor Dandolo had piloted scribed carriages many times before, so he was well acquainted with how to maneuver such a vehicle. But he had never piloted one that suddenly had only one front wheel. And that seemed to have been what had happened. In the blink of an eye, at first they'd been rolling along, and then, suddenly, the driver's front wheel had simply exploded. He shoved down the deceleration lever while also spinning the pilot wheel away from the damaged carriage wheel. But this proved unwise, because then the carriage jumped a wooden walkway, which snapped the other front wheel, which meant he no longer had any control over the carriage's direction at all as it hurtled across the muddy lanes. The world was rattling and quaking around him. But Gregor had sense enough to decipher where the carriage was now headed. And he saw that that space was occupied by a tall, stone building, one that looked well-built.
Oh, dear, he said.
He leapt through into the back of the carriage, where the girl was stuck to the floor. What did you do, you big idiot? She cried at him. Gregor grabbed his espringle and turned the density of her bonds down. Otherwise, they could fly around throughout the carriage and crush him, and certainly her.
Hold on, please, he said. We're about to...
Then the world leapt around them. And Gregor Dandolo remembered. He remembered the carriage crash from long ago. The way the vehicle tipped. The way the world tumbled. The sprinkle of glass and the creak of wood. And he remembered the whimpering in the dark and the glimmer of torchlight from outside. How the light caught the ruined form of Gregor's father, crumpled in the seat, and the face of the young man beside him in the ruined carriage, weeping as his blood poured out of his body. Domenico. He'd died terrified and whimpering in the dark for their mother, the way many young men in this world died, Gregor would later find. Gregor heard whimpering again and had to tell himself, no, no,
that is the past. That all happened long ago.
Then his mother's voice in his ear. Wake up, my love. The muddy world congealed around him, and reality returned. Gregor groaned and looked up. It seemed the carriage had flipped over, so one passenger window was now pointed at the sky, while the other was stuck in the mud. The young woman lay in a heap next to him.
"Are you alive?"
he asked. She coughed. "Why do you give a damn?"
"I am not in the business of killing captured people, even accidentally."
"Are you so sure that was an accident?" she said, her voice rasping. "I told you, they followed you. They're coming for me." Gregor glared at her, then pulled out whip and climbed up through the cab of the carriage. He crawled out the window of the passenger door, which now looked out on the night sky. He sat on the edge of the tipped-over carriage and looked at the front axle. A large, thick metal springle bolt was sticking out of it, right where the wheel had been.
It must have gone right through the spokes of the wheel. And as the wheel spun around it, it shredded the damned thing.
It was an impressive shot. He looked around, but he could see no assailants. They were in one of the larger fairways in Foundryside, but the street was empty. After the building collapse and the shriekers last night, odds were the residents thought if they poked their heads out to see what the commotion was, they'd lose them. The young woman cried, "Ah, shit! Shit! Hey, Captain!"
"What now?"
sighed Gregor. "I'm going to say something else you're not going to believe, but I'm still going to say it."
"You are, of course, free to say what you like, miss."
She hesitated. I can hear scrivings."
You what?"
"I can hear scrivings," she said again. "That's how I knew about the thing on your carriage." He tried to understand what she was implying.
"That's impossible," he said. "No one can just..."
Yeah, said the young woman. "But listen, you need to know this, because right now, a number of very loud scribed rigs are converging on us. I know, because I can hear them, and if they're really loud, that means they must be really powerful." He scoffed.
"I know you think I'm stupid. After all, you have said so both loudly and repeatedly. But it is biologically impossible that someone could be stupid enough to believe that."
He looked around.
"I don't see anyone walking down the street toward us carrying, say, a shrieker."
"I don't hear them on the street. Look up. They're above us." Rolling his eyes, Gregor looked up. And then he froze. On the side of the building facade above him, four stories up, was a masked person dressed all in black. They were standing on the building facade as if it were not the side of a building, but was actually the floor, in full defiance of all known laws of physics, and they were pointing in a springle at him. Gregor dove down into the upended carriage. The next thing he knew, there were a lot of loud thunks. He shook his head and looked up. Five springle bolts were now poking in through the side of the carriage. They had almost punched straight through. And since the walls and floors of this carriage were reinforced, that meant their attackers were using scribed weapons.
"More than one of them," he thought. "At least five."
"Impossible," said Gregor.
"That can't be."
"What?" said the young woman. "What's out there?"
There was a man standing on the building's sides," said Gregor. "Standing there like gravity doesn't work at all."
He looked up through the open window on the side of the carriage and watched in shock as a figure in black appeared to gracefully float over the carriage like a bizarre cloud. Then he pointed in a springle down and fired. Gregor hugged the wall of the carriage as the bolt came hurtling down. The young woman screamed as it thudded into the mud below them. Gregor and the young woman looked at it, then stared at each other. "I scrumming hate being right," she said. Chapter 12. The entire theory of scrying relied on the idea that you could convince an object to behave like something that it wasn't. But the early Tivani scrivers figured out pretty quick that it was a lot easier to convince an object it was something it was similar to, rather than something it was not similar to at all. In other words, It would not take much effort to scribe a block of copper into thinking it was a block of iron. However, it would take an impossible amount of effort to convince the block of copper that it was actually, say, a block of ice or a pile of pudding or a fish. The more convincing an object needed, the more complicated the scribing definitions became, and the more of a lexicon they'd take up. Until finally, you were using a whole lexicon, or even multiple lexicons, to make one scribing work. The first scribers hit this wall pretty quickly, because one of the initial things they tried to alter was an object's gravity. And gravity proved to be a deeply stubborn bastard that simply could not be convinced to do things it didn't believe it ought to. The first efforts to scribe objects to sort of gently, casually step around the laws of gravity were utter disasters. Explosions, mutilations, and maimings were common. This had been a great surprise to the scribers, since they knew from the old stories that the Hierophants had been able to make objects float across the room. And some Hierophants were recorded as flying nearly all the time. The Hierophant Pharnaces was even said to have crushed an entire army with boulders from a mountaintop. But eventually, after an untold number of deaths, the Tavani scribers came up with a somewhat decent solution. The laws of gravity would not be outright denied, but it was possible to obey the laws of gravity in very unusual ways. Like scribed bolts, they were convinced they were just obeying gravity. They just had some interesting new ideas about where the ground was, and how long they'd been falling for. Or floating lanterns, which believed they contained a sack full of gas that was lighter than air, though they did not. All these designs acknowledged the laws of gravity. They just obeyed the letter of the laws rather than the spirit. But despite these successes, the dream stayed alive. Tavani scribers kept trying to find ways to truly defy gravity, to make people float or fly, just like the Hierophants of old, even though such efforts almost always had lethal side effects. For example, some scribers accidentally adjusted their gravity so that two different portions of themselves recognized two different directions of pull, causing their limbs to stretch or simply get ripped clean off their bodies. Others accidentally crushed themselves into a bloody flat disc, or a ball, or a cube, depending on their methodology. Others gravely underestimated the amount of gravity they should have, and they wound up floating away into the ether until they reached the limits of their lexicon, at which point they rather anticlimactically smashed into the surface of the earth. This was considered a pleasant way to go. You had something to bury that way. Many of these attempts had coincided with a larger effort to scribe the human body, and these experiments had been far more horrific than tinkering with gravity. Unimaginably worse. Unspeakably worse. And so, after they'd cleaned up all the bloodstains from the umpteenth disaster, the merchant houses had made a rare diplomatic agreement. They'd all decided that trying to scribe a body or its gravity was to be banned and never trifled with. Humans had enough danger just handling altered items. They didn't need to worry about their own limbs or torsos going haywire on them, too. And that was why Gregor Dandolo simply could not believe what he was seeing as he peeked out the top of the carriage. 9 men, all dressed in black, running across the building faces with impossibly balletic grace. Some even ran upside down along the overhangs of roofs. Such a thing was not only illegal, as much as anything could be in Tavan. It was also, as far as he was aware, technologically impossible. 3 of the men stopped and pointed their springles at him. Gregor ducked back down as bolts punched into the carriage just where he'd been peeking out. "They're good shots, too," he muttered. "Of course." He considered what to do, but there was little he could accomplish, being stuck in a box in the middle of the road.
Do you want to live? Asked the girl.
What?
He said, irritated. Do you want to live? She said again. Because if you do, you should let me go.
Why would I do that?
Because I can help you get out of this.
If I let you go, you'll run off the first second you can get. Or you'll stab me in the back and leave me to get shot full of bolts.
Maybe, she said. But they're here for me, not you. It wouldn't hurt my feelings if you put those bastards in the ground, Captain. I'd be happy to help you do that.
And what could you do to help me?
Something. Which is better than nothing. Besides, Captain, you owe me one. I saved your life, remember?
Scowling, Gregor rubbed his mouth. He hated this. He'd worked ceaselessly to get here, to capture this girl who'd been the source of all his problems. And now he was either going to die for having her, or have to let her go.
But then, slowly, Gregor's priorities shifted. The men flying around up there almost certainly worked for a merchant house. Only a house could have outfitted them with such rigs.
A merchant house is trying to kill me to get the girl, he thought. So they almost certainly also commissioned the theft, of course.
And it was one thing to catch a grubby thief and make a show of her as the cause of great evils in Tavan. But it was quite another to expose massive misconduct, conspiracy, and death being perpetrated by a merchant house faction right here in the city. The merchant houses did conduct espionage and sabotage against one another. Everyone knew that. But there was a bright, unspoken line they did not cross. They did not make war upon one another. War in Tavan would be disastrous. Everyone knew that.
But a bunch of flying assassins, Gregor thought, certainly looks a lot like war.
He reached into the front seat, rummaged around, and brought back a thick metal cord. He quickly fastened it to the girl's left foot with a small, scribed key, which had a dial on the head.
I said to let me go, she said. Not tie me up more. This thing works the same way as the cords on you right now.
He held up the key and pointed to it.
I turn up the dial, and it gets heavier and heavier. You try to run or kill me, and you'll find yourself stuck in one spot out in the open. Or it could crush your foot. So, I recommend you behave.
To his frustration, this didn't seem to intimidate her much.
Yeah, yeah, just get the rest of these things off me, all right?
Gregor glared at her. Then he pulled the release key out of the stock of his espringle and used it to free her.
I assume you haven't ever dealt with assailants such as this before,
he said as she shook off the cords.
No. No, I have not tangled with a bunch of flying assholes before.
How many of them are there?
I counted 9.
She peered up as another assassin danced over the carriage. There was a thunk as the bolt struck the door above. Gregor noticed the girl did not flinch.
They like us out in the open, she said softly, where we're exposed. So how do we get to someplace confined where their tools will offer less advantage?
The girl cocked her head, thought, and then scrambled up to the top window, gripping the edges of the seat. She readied herself, then leapt up with a swift, measured grace, popping up through the window before falling back down to the mud. A chorus of thunks echoed throughout the carriage as she landed.
Shit, she said. They're fast. But at least I know where we are now. You drove the carriage into the Zorzi building, which is lucky. I did not drive it into the building, he said, indignant. We crashed.
Whatever. It used to be a paper mill or something. It stretches across the whole block. A bunch of vagrants live there now, but the top floor is big and open, with lots of windows. And the street on the other side is pretty narrow.
How does that help us?
It doesn't help us, said Sanchia. It helps me, though. He frowned at her.
What exactly are you planning here?
She explained, and Gregor listened. When she was done,
He considered what she was asking of him. It was not a bad plan. He'd heard worse ones.
"Think you can do it?" she asked.
"I know I can," said Gregor. "Do you think you can get into the building?"
"That won't be a problem," she said. "Just give me that big goddamn crossbow."
He handed it over, and she slung it across her back. "I just point and shoot, like a normal espringle, right?"
"Essentially. The cords will wrap around their target, and then they should start amplifying their densities. The more the target moves, of course."
"Terrific."
She pulled two small black balls out of a pocket on her side.
"You ready?"
He climbed up to the open window, looked down, and nodded.
"Here we go."
She took one of the balls in her hand and pressed a small plate on its side. Then she threw one of the balls out the window, waited a beat, and then threw the other. The instant the streets lit up with that incredible, bright, flashing light, Gregor leapt out of the carriage and made a run for it. Despite the fact that he'd witnessed this phenomenon before, the flash and sound of the stun bombs was no less stupefying for Gregor. He caught the barest glimpse of the foundry side street, and then it was all wiped away in a flash of illumination brighter than a lightning strike, followed by a tooth-rattling bang. He staggered blindly for the alley ahead, hands outstretched. He tripped on a porch, crashed into the wooden slats, and crawled forward until he felt a corner of wood. He crawled around the corner, shakily stood, and pressed his back to the wall.
"There. I'm there."
He stood up and began to wobble down the alley, one hand on the wall, the other outstretched before him. The sounds of the stun bomb still ringing in his ears. Eventually, the world took shape around him. He was stumbling down a dark, decrepit alley, lined with refuse and rags. He looked over his shoulder and saw the lights of the stun bombs were fading. Then, six silhouettes emerged in between the building faces of the alley and, bizarrely, began bounding back and forth among the shop fronts like leaves on the wind. Gregor stepped into a shadowed doorway.
"Remarkably odd to see," he thought,
watching them drift gracefully through the air like acrobats on wires. After a moment, a seventh man joined them.
"That's two of them unaccounted for," thought Gregor.
Then he took whip out.
"Still, time to test the limits of gravity."
He watched their progression, calculated their arcs, and flicked whip forward. His shot was true. The truncheon's head caught the man directly in the chest, and since the man's reality had apparently been rearranged to believe he was as light as a feather, he went hurtling off into the sky like he'd been fired out of a cannon. His comrades paused on a linen shop's roof to watch him sail off into the night sky. Then they raised their espringles and fired. Gregor leapt back into the doorway as the bolts thudded around him. Whip came zipping back to its shaft. He waited a beat, then dashed out and started running.
"One down," he thought. "Eight to go."
Sanchia waited quietly underneath the carriage, the big espringle on her back. She tried to ignore her rapid heartbeat and the trembling in her hands. When the stun bombs had gone off, she'd leapt out and hidden in the gap between the carriage and the base of the building. She could hear one of the assassins standing on the top of the carriage, peering down into the empty vehicle. Then she watched, relieved, as he joined his comrades in chasing Gregor down the side alley.
"You think he's gonna make it?" asked Clef.
There was a thud, a cry of pain, and then one of the men came rocketing out of the alley, tumbling ass overhead.
"I think he'll be fine," said Sanchia. "Any more of those rigs nearby?"
"Not that I can tell. I think you're clear."
She wormed her way out from underneath the carriage, pulled Clef off her neck, and stuck him in the side door to the Zorzi building. There was the usual click, and Sanchia darted inside. The place reeked of sulfur and whatever other chemicals they'd used to make paper back in the day. as well as a variety of other, more human smells. Because the bottom floor appeared to have been totally taken over by vagrants. Piles of rags and straw and refuse were everywhere. A few of the occupants cried out at the sight of her, a huge springle slung over her shoulder. Sanchia knelt, touched a bare finger to the ground, and let the layout of the building unscroll in her mind. Once she felt the stairs, she popped up, leapt over one of the shrieking vagrants, and darted over to the hallway that led to the stairs. I hope I make it up in time, she thought. Gregor turned the corner on the fairway, then turned again, until he was headed toward the other side of the Zorzi building. But hopefully his attackers didn't realize that. He looked ahead and saw a welcome sight. There were dozens of clotheslines strung up over the narrow fairway beside the old paper mill, running about four stories up. Old dresses and gray undergarments and bedsheets drifting in the night breeze. Ah, he thought, cover. That should do nicely. He ran to the left, finding shelter under a thick set of off-white bedsheets, and looked up. With the clotheslines above, he was much less exposed. And hopefully, he thought, glancing up, the girl will be getting into position sometime soon. He saw an iron baluster on a balcony across the street, which gave him an idea. He took whip out, aimed carefully, and flicked it at the baluster. With a loud clang, whip's head caught on the iron railing. Gregor pulled the cable taut, hid in a doorway, and waited. He couldn't see them coming through the clothes above. He could only hear the soft scrape of their boots on the building fronts, echoing all around him. He imagined them dancing from rooftop to rooftop, weaving through the hanging clothes, drifting like dust motes on a gentle breeze. But then, as if he were fishing, his line suddenly gave a great leap. There was a gagging sound and a cough. Gregor peeked around the corner and saw one of their attackers spinning wildly through the air, having apparently been caught on Whip's cable. The man sailed through the clotheslines, flying end over end, the lines and clothes wrapping around his form as he coughed. Finally, he crashed into the street below, trailing tangles of clothing like some kind of bizarre kite, and was still. Gregor nodded, pleased. That worked nicely. He hit the switch to retract Whip's head from the baluster. It took a jerk or two from him, but soon the truncheon's head came zipping down and accidentally pulled a string of clothes with it, which, he realized, told his attackers exactly where he was. He looked up as a black-clad man did a flip over the clotheslines, tumbling like an acrobat. Then the man adjusted something on his stomach, which caused him to fall rapidly back toward the building face opposite Gregor, once the man's feet were steady. He looked up at Gregor and raised his springle. Gregor started to flick Whip forward, but he knew it was too late. He could see it happening, see the bolt whipping down at him, see its black tip glinting in the moonlight. He tried to withdraw farther, into the doorway, but then his arm lit up with pain. He cried out and looked at his left arm. He immediately saw that he'd been lucky. The bolt had caught him on the inside bottom of his forearm, slashing it open. The unnatural momentum of the bolt meant it had shredded his flesh as it passed directly through. But it had not speared his arm or hit the bone. Scribed bolts did tremendous damage to the human body. Cursing, Gregor looked up just in time to see a second assassin join the one who'd just fired. And this one, he suspected, would not miss. Gregor fumbled to get Whip ready. The attacker raised his springle. But then, a silvery, strange rope came hurtling from above to wrap itself around the second man's legs. The second attacker staggered as the rope struck him. At least he staggered as much as anyone could while defying gravity and standing on a wall. Praise God, thought Gregor. The girl came through. He looked up, but the windows above were lost in the fluttering storm of laundry. Presumably, She was somewhere up there, firing away. The bound man tried to leap off the building front, but this quickly proved to have been a bad idea. The density cords wrapped around the man's shins believed that, as long as the target they were bound to was not at rest, they would keep increasing their density until it was. However, the man's gravity rig, whatever it was, allowed him to circumnavigate gravity itself, the one force that allowed objects to come to a resting state. So, because of his rig, he could not be at rest. And because he could not be at rest, the bonds got denser and denser. The man started shrieking in surprise and pain, and he slapped at something on his chest, some kind of control mechanism for his gravity rig, probably. This caused him to just float in the middle of the air over the street. But that did not amend his situation, it seemed. His shrieking got higher pitched and louder. There was a sound like a tree root cracking in half or fabric being torn. Then came a horrific spray of blood. And then the man's legs separated from the rest of his body at the knees. Sanchia stared over the sights of her espringle as the man screamed in agony, floating above the street, pouring blood from his knees. She was crouched on the remnants of a wooden walkway that ran the perimeter of the Zorzi's upstairs, peering through the old windows. She'd assumed that shooting the flying men with the espringle would just weigh them down until they couldn't fly anymore. She certainly hadn't thought it would do that. "Oh, God," said Clef, disgusted. "Did you mean for that to happen, kid?" She swallowed her nausea.
"You keep asking me that, Clef," she said.
She started reloading.
"No, I never meant for any of this to happen."
Gregor watched in dull surprise as the man's feet and calves crashed into the earth, still wearing the density bonds. Then the man just hung there in the air, screaming as blood poured out of him onto the ground like a horrific water feature of the neighborhood.
"And that," thought Gregor, "is why Scrivers so rarely fool with gravity."
Understandably, such a phenomenon got one's attention. It certainly seemed to have distracted the man who'd injured Gregor. He was still standing on the building face across the fairway, staring at the sight, having seemingly forgotten all about Gregor. Narrowing his eyes, Gregor took aim with whip and flung the truncheon's head forward at the man. There was a dull plunk sound, and the thick weight cleanly connected with the man's left temple. The man's body went slack, and he dropped the espringle. Then, slowly, his legs slipped off the wall and his unconscious body started drifting over the street. It seemed his rig was set to keep him at a specific level. He neither rose nor fell. It looked like he was slowly skating over an invisible ice pond. Gregor peered at the espringle lying in the mud. Then he got an idea. It was one of his favorite tactics. When outnumbered and outmatched, clutter up the battlefield as much as you can. Only this battlefield, he thought, is the very air above our heads. He took aim at the unconscious, floating man and hurled whip forward. The truncheon's head caught the man's body in the chest, and just as Gregor had hoped, the momentum sent the man ricocheting off the building fronts, hurtling through hanging clothes, bouncing off his dying colleague, and generally wreaking havoc. Gregor watched, satisfied, as the chaos unfolded. One of the men tried to get out of the way and leap across the alley, but the growing tangle of clotheslines caught him like a fish in a net. Gregor scrambled forward, grabbed the espringle, raised it, and shot the tangled man, all in one smooth motion. The man cried out and went still.
"Five down," said Gregor.
"Four left." He looked up, reloaded, and saw two attackers flit across the street and twirl in midair. Gregor tried to draw a bead on one of them, but then both of them gracefully tumbled through the upstairs windows of the Zorzi building. Gregor lowered the espringle.
"Oh, hell," he sighed.
Sanchia saw them coming. She pointed the biggest springle at one of the attackers just as they passed through the windows and fired. But the shot went wide, and the density cords tangled around a rafter, which was, of course, already at rest. So that didn't do much.
Shit, she cried.
She leapt forward as a scribed bolt hurtled toward her. As she fell, she reached into her pocket, grabbed a stun bomb, pressed its plate, and tossed it into the rafters. She knew, of course, that in this terribly dark place, it would blind her as well, along with whichever vagrants were still in there with her. But Sanchia was pretty good at getting around without seeing. The flash of the bomb was tremendous, as was the pop from its charge. For a moment, she just lay there on the walkway, her head ringing and her eyes aching. Clef's voice cut through all her sensory overload.
There's two of them in here with you, he said. Up in the rafters, hiding. They can't see you now, but I'm guessing you can't see them either.
Sanchia was keenly aware that wouldn't last forever. Though the effects might likely last unusually long, given the dark environment. Yet she found she could hear her attackers, or at least their rigs. There was a faint chanting in the blistering, flashing darkness from their gravity rigs. I guess I don't hear scrivings with my ears, she thought, which was a curious revelation. She also realized that these rigs must be terribly powerful for her to be able to hear them from so far away. That gave her an idea. She slipped out her bamboo pipe, which was loaded with a single dollar spina dart.
Clef, can you see in here?
Sure, why wouldn't I?
Clef seemed to not understand this was disturbing, since it suggested his method of seeing things was different from human eyes. She lifted the pipe to her lips.
Tell me if I'm pointing this thing at one of their rigs.
What? Are you serious? This has to be the worst way to...
Just do it, damn it, before they can see again.
Fine. Walk down the walkway about 5 feet. Wait, no, 4 feet. Just stop. Stop. Okay, now. They're on your right. No, God, your other right. Okay. Now keep turning, that's it. Stop. All right. Put the pipe thing in your mouth, point it up. Up more, too far, back down. Down more, that's it. Now to your right just a little. Okay, now, hard.
Sanchia took a deep breath in through her nose and blew as hard as she could. She had no idea what happened. She still couldn't see or hear much. It was like firing the dart into the blackest of nights in here. But then, Clef said,
He moved, just a touch, and now it looks like he's drifting, maybe? I think he got him, kid. I can't believe it.
She could see blurs in the darkness. Her vision was coming back, but only slightly. Let's assume I did, she said. Where's the other one?
On the far wall to your right. You don't have a shot.
I don't need a shot.
She touched her bare hand to the wall beside her, then the rafter above her, and she listened to both of them. She let all the rafters and the supports and the beams overhead pour into her. It was too much, far, far too much. Her head felt like it was going to break open. I'm going to pay for this later, she thought. But she kept going until every inch of the ceiling had made an impression in her thoughts, every beam of wood and every brick fixed in her mind. Then, still mostly blind and deaf, Sanchia leapt up, grabbed a rafter, lifted herself up, and started crawling through the rafters of the Zorzi building with her eyes closed. She couldn't see any of the dangers underneath her, but Clef could.
Oh my God,
he said.
Oh my God.
It would really help, she said, as she blindly leapt from one rafter to another. If you would shut up, Clef.
She kept going, hopping from rafter to rafter, beam to beam, until she felt like she was getting close.
Are we almost there? She asked.
I thought you wanted me to shut up.
Clef.
Yeah, we're almost there. Reach out with your left hand after this next jump. You should feel the wall.
She did so, and found he was right. And as she touched the wall, she felt him. A tight, warm bundle of a person pressed up in the crevice between the wall and the ceiling, like a bat in its roost.
waiting for his vision to return, probably. But the second she felt him, he moved, fast, speeding down. He must have felt me coming, she thought. I hit the damned rafter too hard. But she still felt what the wall felt, and the wall had felt him push off, including how hard and which direction he was going. Sanchia gauged his likely position and blindly jumped into open space. For a moment, she just fell, and she was sure she'd cocked it up, sure she'd missed him, sure she would just plummet 3 stories down into the vagrant's nest, where she'd break a leg or her skull, and then she'd just die there. But then she hit him, hard. Sanchia instinctively threw her arms around the man and clung tightly to him. Her hearing was coming back, and she heard him scream in surprise and anger. They were still falling, but as someone who was somewhat used to falling in space, the way they were falling was so strange. They suddenly, rapidly decelerated to a curiously steady rate, like they were trapped in a floating bubble, twisting through the air. Until they hit the ground. Then the man shoved off, hard, and they went rocketing throughout the old paper mill. The man smashed Sanchia into walls, into rafters, and once into what she guessed was his floating, unconscious comrade. He hurtled back and forth throughout the building, trying to shake her off and struggling with her grasp. But Sanchia was strong, and she held fast. The world was tumbling and twirling about them. The vagrants were screaming and shrieking, and her sight was slowly, slowly coming back to her. She saw the 4th-floor windows flying at them, and realized what was going to happen. "Ah, shit!" she cried. They crashed through a pair of shutters, and then they were outside, flying through the open night air, still tumbling over and over and over. Now he could fly up a mile and dump her off, or have one of his comrades pry her off and slit her throat, or... "The controls for his rig are on his stomach!" Clef shouted at her. Sanchia clung tighter to him, gritted her teeth, and started swatting at the man's stomach with her hand, clawing and tearing at anything she could find there. Then her hand felt a small wheel, which she managed to turn. They froze, hanging in midair. "No!" screamed the man. And then he seemed to explode. It was as if someone had filled a huge water skin with hot blood and jumped on it. The spray of gore was unspeakably tremendous and totally shocking to Sanchia. More concerning, though, was that the man she'd leapt on was no longer, well, there. It was as if he'd simply disappeared, leaving only the scribed gravity device behind, which meant Sanchia was now falling. She tried to grab at something, anything. The only thing to hold onto was the dead man's device, which was covered in blood. She grabbed it purely out of instinct, yet this did nothing. Everything seemed to slow down as she fell to the fairway below. "Bad!" cried Clef. "This is real bad!" Sanchia had no mind to answer. The world was sliding by her, every ripple of the bedsheets and twist of the undergarments frozen in space. And then, Gregor Dandolo was there, beneath her. He cried out in pain as Sanchia landed in his arms. Sanchia herself was still dumbfounded, her mind reeling as she tried to understand what had just happened. Then, he dumped her in the mud, cursing and rubbing his lower vertebrae. You caught me, she said aloud, still stunned. He groaned and fell to his knees. "My scrumming back! Consider my debt repaid," he snarled. She looked at herself. She was trembling, absolutely covered in blood, and she still clutched the gravity device in her hands. It looked like 2 plates connected with cloth bands, one for your belly, one for your back, and one plate had a series of little dials on it. She stammered out, I...
"You must have sabotaged the device he was using to float," said Gregor.
He looked up at the bedsheets above, which were all spattered with gore,
causing his gravity to collapse, crushing him. Somewhere in the street is probably a fleshy marble that was once the whole of that man's body.
He looked around.
"Help me up. Now."
"Why? That's all of them, right?"
"No.
That was just 7. There were 9 in total.
Gregor never got the chance to finish. Because then, the remaining 2 attackers crested the peaks of the roofs on one